Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for fans and collectors of vinyl records. And this week we are talking with Jimi Hendrix musical archivist, John McDermott. John is part of Experience Hendrix, the organization who manages the Jimi Hendrix estate since the 1990s. John has also written several books about the brilliant guitarist and has overseen the conservation, re-representation, and reissues of Hendrix music and LPs for many years. Today, John is going to give us a peek into the history of the posthumous Hendrix releases, as well as the approach that is taken to prepare and make these recordings available. And today, we also discuss the latest Hendrix release, Both Sides of the Sky, featuring Hendrix recordings rarely, if ever, heard outside his inner circle. Both Sides of the Sky is available on March 9th, so go shake down your local record store clerk about getting a copy. And we are brought to you in part today by GrooveWasher.com. Did you know that around 70% of dust is comprised of flakes of human skin? Ooh. And if you have vinyl records and skin, well, you've got a problem. Get yourself a Groove Washer record cleaning kit today and make sure your records are skin-free. The Groove Washer is the best bang for the buck. Sure, you can invest $1,000 or more in a large record cleaning machine, but man, that's a lot of dough. Save your cash and get a Groove Washer record cleaning kit for less than $50 at GrooveWasher.com. Check them out today or bother your retailer for a Groove Washer. Everything else is bollocks. And with that, let's get on to our conversation with John McDermott, archivist and historian for the music and legacy of Jimi Hendrix.
Do you listen to and collect vinyl records? Well, you're in luck. Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast made for record nerds like yourself. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Alrighty, let's get this party started. Hi everyone, it's Nate, host of The Vinyl Guide, the weekly podcast where we talk about vinyl records and, of course, talk to the artists and hear the stories behind them. And, wow, it's been a big couple of weeks. In the last 2 weeks, we've had 4 episodes. You know, normally we're a weekly sort of affair, but, you know, I felt extremely ambitious the last few weeks. Let's go. 2 weeks ago, we had 2 episodes featuring Jacko M. Jackcheck of King Crimson, and man, we got a lot of great feedback on those stories. That was really fun. 2 episodes all about King Crimson and Jacko's history, so make sure you check those out. And last week, I was planning on having 1 episode, episode with the Discog CEO, Chad Dahlstrom. We had Chad stop by and hit the hot seat and expertly field questions from Vinyl Guide listeners. Again, Discogs is a great service. You really can't beat the free price tag. Still, a lot of people tend to be frustrated and have opinions on the service. So if you do as well, or interested at least in what the future of Discogs is, take a listen to the challenges and the ambitions of Chad and the Discogs crew in episode number 113. Also last week, we did a surprise second episode. It was a double episode week for The Vinyl Guide. Episode number 114 with Zach Wilde, guitarist of Black Label Society, and of course, Ozzy Osbourne's solo band. And man, what a character Zach was. We only had 30 minutes for the interview, so it was a bit shorter than normal, and the audio quality wasn't the greatest, but still the hilarity came through, so I decided to share it as a bit of a bonus. A freebie, if you like. See that? I'm always thinking of you guys. So do me a favor. Think of me and share this podcast with all your weirdo record friends and get them all listening to The Vinyl Guide. So this week, I am super excited. We are speaking with John McDermott, musical archivist for Experience Hendrix, a team which manages Jimmy's legacy. Now today, John is going to take us through the timeline from the weeks and months after Jimmy died up until this week when they are releasing what may be the last big stash of unheard Hendrix recordings. Both Sides of the Sky is going to be available March 9th, available on vinyl, of course, and all lesser formats. Now, what you got to know is in the final months of Jimmy's life, he kept recording, he was planning more albums, of course, he was very prolific. And then poof, when he died, there were all these tapes with partially recorded songs, jam sessions, covers, and the like. The Experience Hendrix team has been managing these tapes and making them available for several years, keeping the spirit of Jimmy alive and allowing us all a glimpse into the way he worked. So after March 9th, check out Both Sides of the Sky. Again, there's not a lot of recordings left, so Both Sides of the Sky is very special. And I do want to share that if you like this episode and hearing the stories of archives and such, check out our interview with Greg Brooks, archivist for the band Queen. Those are Vinyl Guide episodes number 79 and 80. Greg takes us through a very similar history, a similar story with Queen, their tapes, the discoveries, and how they continually make new material available for fans. So that is the Vinyl Guide episodes number 79 and 80, all on the Queen Archive. So without further chit-chat, let's get on to our conversation with John McDermott of Experience Hendrix. Today, we are pleased to have on the Vinyl Guide John McDermott, manager of the Jimi Hendrix catalog, co-producer of many of the titles, working alongside Janine Hendrix and Eddie Kramer at Experience Hendrix, the team which controls the estate, the brand, and the media of Jimi Hendrix. Thanks for coming on the show today, John.
Sure, happy to help out.
So there's a new set of Hendrix recordings, Both Sides of the Sky, being released on March 9th. And I definitely want to take some time to discuss this. I'm fascinated by these recordings coming out nearly 50 years after Jimmy left us. But before we do, let's quickly go back to September 1970. Jimmy was a solo artist, not part of a group. He wasn't married. No close heirs for his items, his property, his recordings. I'm even unclear if he had a will. And his passing was entirely unexpected. No one was prepared. It seems like an environment ripe for opportunists to take control. What happened to Jimmy's recordings and possessions in the weeks and months immediately following his death?
Well, I think that, at the time of Jimmy's death, he was very actively involved in creating what would have been his next studio record. He was planning a double studio record comprised, I would say mostly of material that was either recorded wholly at his new recording studio or would be from recordings that were made in the previous couple of years at studios like Olympic or the Record Plant, where he would take them into Electric Lady to either overdub on them, mix them. So I think he was in a stage, given the construction of his studio, where he had amassed a great wealth of material. I think he'd used a lot of 1969 in particular to write material and develop material, particularly with different sets of musicians. So, Electric Lady, was kind of teeming with tapes at the time of Jimmy's death. Now, naturally, in the aftermath of his death, you had tapes at other studios, you had, all kinds of issues that were going on. But for the most part, everything was still pretty much close to hand at the time of his death. And I just think that in the years that followed, that's when things started to go awry, when issues with managers or lawyers started to pop up and people withheld certain tapes or wouldn't, give back certain things. And as these things invariably go, the longer they are not resolved, then that's when, we've had to kind of go in there almost as an archaeological dig and say, okay, all right, where is this? What happened here? How do we solve this issue? And, at the end of the day, you are rewarded with, a great cache of Jimi Hendrix, recorded media. So I think that, for the most part, at the time of his death, Jimmy kind of had his arms around a good chunk of it because he was very much aware of what he wanted to, to put forward on his next record. I mean, nobody knows what that would have been because, that was an active process in which he was, recording, and he just bursting with creativity at the time of his death. So, I mean, I think that the unique circumstances of his life and sadly his death kind of led to the situations that in these almost 48 years since his passing that, you've had to take not only the material that kind of never went astray, but then, cast the net as wide as you can to get everything else of real value back into the library so that you can, make sense of what's there and then hopefully present the best of it to his fans.
Do you feel that Experience Hendrix has the majority, if not all, the tapes that exist, or is there still stuff out there?
Well, there's always going to be stuff out there, but I think for the most part, we've spent these last 20 years, you know, kind of bringing that those finds to the public. So, you know, whether they, you know, encompass live recordings or home demos or multi-track studio recordings, I mean, they've all been part of what we've drawn on the existing library, and then all of these other things that we've had to kind of get our arms around. So, you know, in a perfect world, it would have been great to have had everything in one place in, you know, when we started, of course, but it's better at the end of the day, it's better that they have been recovered. I mean, we, you know, as a fan, I had long heard and, you know, hoped that someday the, for example, the Miami Pop Festival sound and film would be found. And, you know, we were fortunate to have done that. And that's a great example of being able to come up with something extraordinary and share it with fans, because, you know, to not would be, God, it'd be a shame. I mean, for fans not to be able to see Jimmy, you know, performing with such power and technique and just, it's an extraordinary visual document of his playing. And at the same time, the performance itself is really great. So I think the, it's important work that we've done. It'd be great if everything was there when we started at the starting line. I mean, I think it would have shaped certain releases we put out perhaps differently, but at the end of the day, it's all about, you know, making the very best of Jimmy available to fans. And that's kind of been the mission since day one. So we're hoping that we're meeting that goal for our fellow fans out there.
Well, you're doing an incredible job. And I think the constant cadence of releases and finding new recordings and making those available is something that the organization does quite well. How often do you find new stuff? How often does something pop up and surprise you?
Well, pop up and surprise, not as, I mean, but of course, thankfully, it's usually something every year. It could be photographs, could be just a short little film, it could be anything. But I think when the Hendrix family had to litigate to get control back of the family company, which they formed, you know, all of Jimmy's IP, they had to litigate to get back in 93, 4, 5. And I think that, you know, that was the beginning roadmap of, all right, as soon as you settle this, then you got to go solve this 10 problems you got to go solve. And that would, you know, that's what freed up a lot of the material, you know, that we've been able to access.
Did certain tapes go missing? Is there stuff that's still missing, unaccounted for, that is being searched for?
Yeah, sure there is. There always is. And there's also stuff that we had heard about that was, you know, that was filmed or videotaped. And, you know, there's... You never truly know, and we're always very pleasantly surprised when someone pops up and says, oh, by the way, I have this, and it's in my parents' attic, and I did it, and, you know, do you think it's anything? And you look at it, and it's, you know, a black and white video recording of Jimmy's Woodstock performance, and you're like, you know, it's spectacular, it's great. So we're always, always hopeful that, you know, things that we have some evidence of being, you know, either professionally or semi-professionally recorded or filmed, we're always on the hunt for that material.
Now, there seems to be a lot in, and I'll call it the archive, even though I think that's that may be a very non-descriptive name for the breadth of things that you guys do. But inside the archive, there's obviously audio, there's video. It sounds like there's a lot of pictures. What else is in the archive that is stored and controlled by the Experience Hendrix Company?
Well, I mean, I think you've nailed it. I think those are the key items. You know, I mean, I think at the end of the day, Al Hendrix, Jimmy's dad, wanted Jimmy's, a lot of his materials to be publicly displayed for his fans. So, you know, there is a permanent exhibit at the Rock Hall, there's a permanent exhibit at the EMP in Seattle, the Smithsonian, the Native American exhibit at the Smithsonian, the African American Museum in D.C., and as well as the Northwest African American Museum have things. So I think that that's a good part of being able to see Jimmy's famous butterfly costume or the outfit he wore when he performed in Maui, or, you know, and so I think, you know, those things are there. I think it's more of the what I'll call the recorded media that I deal with that is stored, and it encompasses really, you know, everything from his 8 millimeter movies and 8, you know, rough mix 7.5 IPS, you know, consumer grade tapes to, you know, his professional two-track masters.
Did Jimmy hang on to a lot of stuff? I mean, I noticed he's a lot of his lyrics, his original lyrics that he wrote on hotel stationery exist.
Sure.
Did he keep a lot of other things around his career?
A lot of things went missing after he died, without question.
Mm. And those are the sort of things you're still on the hunt for, still searching for on a daily
yes,
basis.
Yes, of course.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there a holy grail of Jimi Hendrix media out there that you know exists but you haven't gotten yet?
Well, I mean, look, anything that's really great is wonderful to get, but certainly we've been looking, you know, Miami was one of the things on that list. There's a videotape of Jimmy performing in Dallas in 1970. That's out there. There's a bunch of things that we've been told were filmed and recorded or recorded, what have you. We just haven't been able to reel them in.
Mm. Now, when Experience Hendrix started putting together, I guess, the first of this trilogy, First Rays of the New Rising Sun, this was a release that...
Well, no. The first one that of the unreleased material was a record called Valleys of Neptune. First Rays was the first release that we did, but that was to pull together the material that was Jimmy was working on for his final record.
Mm.
So this stuff here, that the last three records, the studio records we put out, are different. The First Rays encompassed a lot of Cry of Love, Rainbow Bridge, the first posthumous records that had come out.
Mm-hmm.
They had been taken off of the market by Alan Douglas, who preceded the Hendrix family, kind of controlling the releases.
Mm-hmm.
So he had removed those titles from the marketplace, so we felt it was important to bring them back. I mean, you know, there were songs that were just crucial and critical to the Hendrix canon that had to be, you know, readily available, and that was the purpose of First Rays.
Okay, so First Rays, that was an attempt to hold the vision that Jimmy had for his follow-up album, the album he was working on at the time of his death. In your estimation, right, how complete was that project, and what was left behind to help understand what the vision was?
Well, there's no way that you can say that it's complete without question, because I think Jimmy worked on Electric Ladyland to the last possible minute. So, you know, he worked on Axis Bold as Love to the last possible minute. So I don't think that there's, there's no documentation or no roadmap left by Jimmy, for example, that we could look at and say, oh yeah, that's the sequence, that's the layout, because I still feel that there was a lot of material to be recorded that would have made that final record. So I think for us, what we try to do is, based on, you know, all the research we had done, all the work that had been done by Jimmy and Eddie building up to it, talking to Mitch Mitchell, talking to, you know, Billy Cox and others that are involved, we felt, you know, these were the recordings, particularly Eddie's memory, that, you know, were in the forefront of consideration. So, you know, it's very possible that something may have changed, but I think, you know, Eddie was, you know, we even had Eddie's notes, original notes for the Cry of Love album that we referenced. And so it was kind of important to make sure that Dolly Dagger and Freedom and Nightbird Flying and, you know, Room Full of Mirrors, like all these really important songs were kind of back again available to people. One can never say that, hell yeah, this is exactly how Jimmy would have done it. We can't speak for him in that way, but what we can do is share the music in a way with context, with a full annotation, a full understanding, so that fans can kind of come away with a better, you know, maybe a deeper appreciation and contextual understanding of what, you know, what we're doing or why this particular music is important to listen to.
And from what I understand, the recordings are less entire songs, but quite often snippets here and there or sketches of what he was working on at the time. How do you go about filling in the color in the tapes where there really isn't a fully formed, fully matured song?
Well, I don't think you do. I think you again use the release to share with people the process. I think if you look, we put out a box set called the Jimi Hendrix Experience. It's purple 4-CD set, and later a 4-CD set called the West Coast Seattle Boy. And there you're going to hear, you know, kind of single guitar demos. You're going to hear early studio things, some with vocal, some without vocal. And I think that for fans, you know, what we've tried to do is say, here's when it was recorded, here's who it was recorded, here's, you know, what the, you know, the general understanding is of where it fit into the whole piece. And I think when you do that, it allows folks to kind of say, okay, so that's the original experience post Electric Ladyland, prior to the band, original band breaking up. You know, you get a sense of where Jimmy was creatively at that time. But, you know, it's we really don't, you know, you don't do anything to the recording. I mean, certainly Eddie Kramer, God bless him, does a wonderful job, you know, mixing and preparing and doing everything he can technically to kind of make it shine as best it can. But, you know, it's nothing articulates Hendrix better than Hendrix. So our job is kind of describe it, present it, and get out of the way.
Mm. Okay, so nothing is added instrumentally or anything to any of these new releases. Okay.
No.
All right.
No.
And in the past, there was, though. So I think in the Jeffrey and...
Oh, yeah. No. Actually, well, it was actually Alan Douglas. There were a couple of records, and then he did another one in the 90s where he had Bruce Gary from The Knack overdub drums on things. So, yeah, no, that direction isn't anything we've ever done or would ever consider. I think it's a... I think fans understand in this, you know, in what I'll call the more modern era, they understand the concept of outtakes and works in development, and I think they quite like it. You know, I think when you can hear the Beatles anthology or you can hear the Jimi Hendrix Experience box set or, you know, any of the, there's been a deluxe edition, for example, of Exile on Main Street. I think when you get to hear those songs in their formative state, fans get it. They understand it. They realize, okay, you know, this is a different approach to, hear my train of coming. And this is why, you know, I can see why they put it out. It's cool. It's with the band of Gypsies as opposed to the Experience. It's, you know, done in this way. It sounds this way. I mean, I think that's more of the goal for us than to, you know, try to force something into something it's not.
Okay. Well, yeah. Something Jimi Hendrix, even an unmature Jimi Hendrix thought is better than not hearing it at all. So...
Well, remember, we've also started a bootleg label for fans with records that aren't sold in stores, and we get to even go even deeper there, so that, you know, some of the jams that Jimmy did, particularly with Billy Cox and Buddy Miles, are extraordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're able to put, you know, a 19-minute suite of, you know, maybe 7 songs that Jimmy's actively writing that are all beautifully blended together in these medleys. In these jam sessions, and I think fans can hear it and say, ah, okay, so this is how he approached songwriting, kind of winnowing down these riffs, these rhythm patterns till, you know, he felt he had formed them into the song that he heard in his head. So it's all part of the overall presentation from our side, which is, you know, hey, here's a cool window into Jimmy's creativity, and this is what, you know, look out for and listen to. And, it seems to have worked with fans.
Mm-hmm. So throughout the 70s and up to now, there's really 3 phases of the post-Hendrix releases. There was the Michael Jeffrey phase. He was the manager of Jimmy, and he managed the Hendrix tapes until his own death in 73. Then there was Alan Douglas, who stepped into the picture.
Yep.
I'm not sure how he got in there. I mean, Michael Jeffrey was obviously the manager, so he had the relationship. Right. How did Alan Douglas then step in after Michael Jeffrey?
Long story, probably I'd best direct you to, you know, one of the books I've done. But the short of it is that, you know, Alan went to Al Hendrix's lawyer, Leo Branton, and Warner Brothers, an executive there, Don Schmitzerly, and said, you know, Eddie Kramer had stepped away from the process. And so Schmitzerly was looking to, you know, release more music. And Douglas was like, oh, I recorded all this stuff with Jimmy. And in the end, it was just an entree to get into the library. And then when he was there, you know, he kind of put forward the idea of that, you know, he was aware of these particular recordings. He was going to have new people overdub on them. And, you know, it was obviously a very controversial move.
Mm-hmm. Was it destructive, or have you been able to roll some of those changes back and get the original drums?
Some tapes were cut, and we've never been able to find the reels and rebuild them the way they originally were. And in some instances where they were open tracks, we can, you know, still, you know, present and have done so, you know, the original performances by a Buddy Miles or a Mitch Mitchell or somebody like that.
And then the third phase is the Experience Hendrix phase. We're still in there. Pulled together from Al Hendrix, Jimmy's dad. What instigated the Hendrix family to really get serious about preserving Jimmy's legacy?
Well, I think Al, it was always his desire and wish. I mean, you know, I mean, Jimmy may be a one-dimensional hero to, say, me, but, you know, was Al's son. So I think he always wanted to, you know, put Jimmy's best foot forward. And I think when he litigated to get the full control back, you know, that was really his mandate. And that's been our effort since 95.
Does Experience Hendrix get involved in authenticating things? Like if there was a document, the Jimmy's signature or a guitar that he supposedly played, does the team look?
I just deal with the cat. Yeah, no, I mean, our primary focus, I'm sure there are some folks that do that, but you know, my thing is, you know, working on the music.
Okay. And you've been a Hendrix fan. So, I mean, as you mentioned, you've written books on Jimmy. Did you ever see Jimmy live?
I did not. No, I was a little too young. Missed it.
Okay. And how did you come across Jimmy's music?
Well, just, you know, I mean, like every young person today, I mean, he's the touchstone artist that you go to. And, you know, as somebody who was interested in blues, I kind of came to Jimmy through that way. But, you know, he was, the talent is always what shines through. And, you know, whether it's the Beatles or Muddy Waters, I mean, when you hear something that unique and really brilliantly created, you know, the reaction is immediate, and certainly I felt it, and I've always enjoyed the music since that time.
I think you're underselling the word enjoyment there. I mean, most fans don't go off and write books and end up working in the archive. I mean, you have what is essentially a dream
job. Well, but
job,
you know,
yeah?
I will say this. I think the thing about Jimmy is it's a fascinating story. I think, you know, when you think about a guy who, you know, was denied really every opportunity to showcase his skill. And I think that, you know, when you look at what Chaz Chandler gave him, the gift of opportunity, I mean, it's really, that's the foundation for a tremendous story. I mean, Chaz, you know, this is a guy who was the bass player in a very successful band, 10 top 40 hits, they're on a roll. And, you know, he sees a talent greater than his own and, you know, really has a vision. And that story is very compelling. And I think what Jimmy did right from Jump Street is what fascinated me. And I think the changes that Hendrix brought about in the business, in terms of touring, in terms of merchandise, in terms of, you know, his technical command, like all those things were really amazing. And I think that as the business grew from a music business to a music industry, you know, it's pretty remarkable what Jimmy was able to do, you know, in a time when things were kind of like the Wild West, where, you know, the whole idea of rolling up into a basketball arena and, you know, playing a rock and roll show. I mean, if you look at the Beatles footage from even 66, you know, they're playing through tiny Vox amps and, you know, it's a whole different experience. I mean, you jump forward less than a year and Hendrix is at Monterey at Paul McCartney's invitation, burning the guitar and changing the world. So it's a pretty remarkable transformation. It always captivated me, and I think that's what's been kind of the engine for me to kind of dig into writing about him and working on all these various projects.
There's also the extreme fortune that he was popular in his time, even though it was 4 or 5 short years. He was extremely prolific, and he was popular to the point to where people did want to do things like film him, video him. So there's a lot of collateral out
well,
there.
I think what's interesting is that it's the filming of him in many ways, which made him such an icon, because I don't think he sought it. I think he was one of the guys who didn't seek out, you know, it's so different from today's kind of culture of celebrity. I mean, you know, Jimi Hendrix is a lot of mystery to him. He was a counterculture figure who was not, you know, when he went on a show, and that was very rare to promote something, you know, he didn't play his hits. You know, in America, he went on the Dick Cavett Show and played 2 songs that hadn't been released on a record. He played another song on Tonight Show, hadn't been out on a record. So, I mean, he wasn't a record company's dream in that sense, in that, hey, you know, I'm going to come on and do what you already know. I think he just was a restless creative spirit who, you know, was always kind of pointing forward. And that's interesting to see when when the Monterey film came out, Jimmy, you know, was already kind of into his second record and on a roll. So for many fans, their first glimpse of him was him lighting the guitar on fire. You can't imagine. You're thinking like, what on earth is this? And then I think you jumpstart that a couple of years later and you see the Woodstock film, which had an enormous impact on youth culture throughout the world. And Hendrix is rightly kind of featured at the end of the film, playing the Star Spangled Banner and, you know, Voodoo Child, and just putting on an amazing performance. And, you know, I think that's when people like realize, like, I want to see this guy. I want to hear more of this guy. And I think that that energy has kind of kept him out there as, you know, a truly unique talent that, you know, sadly he died, but, you know, the music that he left behind is in almost a constant state of discovery, you know, whether it's successive generations or it's stuff people feel they missed. And, you know, they love the first record or the first singles, and then all of a sudden they hear Band of Gypsies and they're like, oh my God, this is a whole different experience here. So I do think that's a part of it. He left a deep well, and it's, you know, there's a lot of really great stuff that, you know, you could be a guitar fan of anybody from Clapton to Beck to Page, you name it, Buddy Guy, it doesn't matter. I mean, it still sounds as fresh and exciting today as it did, you know, in 1970.
Mm-hmm. And through the tapes that have been collected and produced and developed into projects like Valleys of Neptune, People, Hell, and Angels.
Sure.
Now we have Both Sides of the Sky. This is, as you say, the third in the trilogy. What is Both Sides of the Sky going to tell us about the Jimi Hendrix life and story that we don't already know?
Well, I think it's more examples of you know, his developing sound and direction. I think to hear some of the things in there, you know, whether it's kind of the end of the original experience and a tremendous version of Hear My Train of Coming, or in a completely different vein, hear how Jimmy, you know, being really a guy who understood what it took to be a session man, you know, playing amazingly on the two songs led by Stephen Stills, where, you know, he's suiting the song, serving the song, as opposed to saying, hey, I'm Jimi Hendrix, I'm going to play all over this thing. You know, so I think that, you know, that's an interesting thing. I think hearing him, you know, play Woodstock with Buddy Miles and Stephen Stills before CSNY recorded it, I think is an amazing thing. I even think it was done before Joni herself was able to record her version. But at the end of the day, it's, you know, that's a riff, for example, you know, when you hear Jimmy playing that on the bass in that song. Well, if you jump forward to, you know, January of 70, he's playing that figure in Send My Love to Linda, you know, that descending, you know, kind of bass line, guitar line figure. So it's typical of Jimmy. I mean, you know, he would, songs like Easy Rider were in development for years, and he just, you know, was waiting for the right moment. I think when you listen to Sweet Angel on the new record, you know, it sounds remarkably different from the version that's on First Rays. But it just goes to show, he, you know, the genesis of these great ideas were all in there, and I think he was searching for ways to, you know, and for the right setting and personnel to document them. And that's kind of an interesting process to hear on People, Hell, and Angels, the Band of Gypsies doing Hear My Train of Coming. You know, it's a tremendous performance, and it shows that kind of blues root that those guys shared. You jump forward to this record and you have their version of Mannish Boy, and, you know, they tear it up. Mm-hmm. So I think each one of these songs fills in the picture. And I think when you have your library of Jimmy, it allows you to kind of put some things into certain, you know, folders and, you know, groupings where you're like, you know, I want to hear Jimmy dive into the blues. I just want to hear Jimmy with the Band of Gypsies. I just want to hear the original experience. And that's our hope, is that, you know, we've supplied enough really great examples of all of what remains in the library so that people feel like, you know what, while I wish Jimmy were here and making more, what he left us is really, you know, tremendous.
Well, that's exactly how I use the releases from Experience Hendrix. I often use the organization as an example of a great way to be able to honor the legacy of a musician, especially the vinyl issues. They sound phenomenal. And I have first issue tracks that, you know, normally that's the go-to record, the first pressings, but the Experience Hendrix vinyl is really quite fun and a very good sound. They come with additional booklets, lots of additional information. What steps are taken specifically for the vinyl releases of Jimmy's work?
Well, we work with Bernie Grundman for mastering, who's a really wonderfully talented mastering engineer. So we also all of the records, since we've been, I would say, for the last 6 or 7 years since they've started, we use Quality Record Manufacturing in Salina, Kansas. They're probably, you know, we feel they're the best in the world in terms of quality. And they are really dedicated to vinyl and to making it sound great. They don't, you know, this, they don't do it on the cheap. I mean, we really, you know, we use heavyweight, you know, audiophile grade vinyl. We really just want to make that experience, you know, to, as best we can. You know, I mean, you vinyl, for somebody who's making an investment on vinyl, whether they're either replacing, like, you know, you were saying, an original track, or, you know, an old reprise pressing that's worn out, you know, you want that, our experience, to have that same power, and you want Electric Ladyland to have that same impact when you hear it. And I think we try to do that with, whether it's the Miami Festival or whether it's Berkeley or Monterey or any of these other things we put out. You know, it's that same thing where we want the vinyl, we want fans to really feel like, wow, this is special. It not only is Jimmy special, but like, this is worth his, you know, being part of his library. So we take it very seriously.
Speaking of the records that were released during his lifetime, Axis, Electric Ladyland,
yeah,
Experience, are those remixed at all? Do you go back to the multi-tracks?
No.
Of those? Those are
No.
The original mixes.
Yeah, his mixes. Yep.
Okay. Same with the
mods. Yeah, we always try to do that. Yeah. I think, you know, he only made one discrete, you know, like, for example, Electric Ladyland was never done in mono. I mean, that was stereo only. But Axis, for example, you know, they made a discrete mono mix. He was present. You know, we've put it out just as it is. And for those who like mono, you have that, you know. But I think it's really, you know, as I say, nothing articulates Hendrix better than Hendrix. So when he's fixed it, we always use that. Like, whenever possible, if we've got like a finished mix, or we've got, like, in that case, an album mix, we don't want to change it. We don't want to play with it.
Mm-hmm. With the release of Both Sides of the Sky, is there much left?
Well, certainly there's live material, there's demo material, there's certainly things left. But, you know, we felt that these three records were the, you know, the best of the remaining studio material. You know, if we're able to find, you know, some more amazing stuff, of course we're going to share it. I mean, it isn't like, hey, this is it, hurry up and get it, it may go. I mean, mm-hmm. You know, it's not that kind of an effort. We just kind of wanted to have easily understood packages that, you know, I think it's important to state, like, this isn't the lost album and the lost song and the lost chord and the lost cheeseburger. I mean, there's none of that going on. It's just, these are the songs and material we felt were the best of the remaining, you know, kind of more formal studio recordings, or were really important to showcase for folks to say, yeah, you know, you should hear this. So certainly it's possible for other things to be released in the future. One never knows. But I think in terms of our goal, you know, between what we've been able to showcase on the box sets and these releases like Both Sides, that really was our full intention when we started this process.
And is it fair to say that the majority of these tracks haven't been heard outside of the Hendrix studios? I mean, was Manish Boy bootlegged, or any of the other songs?
Well, it's hard to really truly measure that. But yeah, you know, I mean, there are some things that folks have heard, but there's certainly things they've never heard. And, you know, which is okay too. I mean, mm-hmm. Even if you've heard it, it might be in a crappy MP3 bootleg or some, you know, wacky thing, but that's not, we're not trying to better someone's bootleg collection. You know what I mean? If you heard it, fine. But I mean, here's, like, you know, part of the process of this is, you know, getting Eddie as close to the original source material as possible, whether he himself recorded it or another engineer like Gary Kelgren, who's since passed away, or one of the other great guys that, you know, they worked with back in the day. Our goal is to get back to the original tape, you know, mix it from there, you know, just as Eddie did in the day. You know, he is that connection for us to the original creation and the understanding of how things were done sonically. And, you know, I think that we've been so lucky to have Kramer to guide the process. It really has been, you know, it's not dissimilar to somebody like a George Martin kind of involving himself, continuing, you know, up until his passing with the many various Beatle reissues that were released.
Yeah, I imagine there must be some emotional moments for Eddie going through some of these tapes, reliving times that he may have forgot about and was just reminded of when he heard the tape. Is it hard to go through those tapes for the group?
Well, not for me. I mean, to me, it's a tremendous discovery. I think even for Eddie, I think he enjoys it. It's, I think he's very happy, given the 20 years now plus that we've been doing this. You know, as he says, to be able to shine a light on Jimmy in a positive way, for people to really hear this music and understand that, you know, this guy was teeming with great ideas and was a really great person. And I think as Eddie's gotten older, that's become more important to him, is, you know, recognizing that, you know, this was a really special guy. And, you know, during a relatively short window, he was able to make a huge impact. And so I think that drives him in a lot of ways. I think, you know, he has very fond memories of working with Jimmy, and, you know, and in the faith that Jimmy placed in him, you know, to help him and to, you know, record him in the studio and concerts, help him build his studio. I mean, you know, that's something that stayed with Kramer since then.
Mm. And being that this is the Vinyl Guide show here, I have to ask the question. After Jimmy's death, you said his possessions kind of got scattered. Do you know if his record collection went somewhere?
Well, there are some folks that have some elements of it, yes. But I think it was in multiple places. So, you know, he had his main apartment is in New York, you know, had his records there and had records in his London apartment. You know, so I think this is a guy who was deep, you know, loved his blues records. It's just, you know, Faye Pridgeon, who was his dear friend and girlfriend from the, you know, pre-experience period, you know, her mother was a big blues fan, and she had her own records plus the new records that they were buying from people like Elmore James and the like. And you know, she told me great stories of how they, you know, Jimmy would just sit with his guitar and, you know, play his guitar to records that he loved, blues records, Guitar Slim and Elmore James and Muddy Waters and people like that. And so I do think that, you know, this is a guy who dug records. You know, she has said many times they'd be down at the Colony, you know, near at Colony Records or up at Bobby Robinson's store up in Harlem, and, you know, she'd be thinking, man, that's our dinner, and we're buying records. So you know, I think even when he didn't have any money, man, it just was all about, you know, music, hearing music, playing music. You know, that was what drove this guy.
Wow. Well, he and I have something in common. I've passed a few meals as well just to buy a record.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in your involvement with Experience Hendrix, do you deal much with original pressings? Like, for instance, are you familiar with the track pressing of Axis and the insert?
Oh, God, yeah. No, we use those as reference. And, you know, we involve Bill Levinson, who's a, you know, kind of the best in the business at the box set producing and, you know, reissue producing. You know, we have him listen to things. So, yeah, we're always looking at stuff and, you know, I mean, we pull out, you know, our originals to, you know, try to, you know, hear what we've done. I mean, I think, too, I mean, you understand the vinyl part of it is that, you know, in the old days, you had a lot of rolling off of the top and the bottom, you know, and I think that what we've been able to do is to get away from that and go back to the original flat masters. So when you listen to Electric Ladyland, it is, in effect, virtually a true representation of the mix that Jimmy's put to tape. Mm-hmm. So, you know, while a mastering engineer is certainly adding things to it, it's not already, you know, kind of rolled off for level purposes the way that things used to be during Jimmy's lifetime. I mean, you know, remember, another thing that you think about Jimmy, the changes he made to all various aspects of the business, you know, Jimmy and Eddie reached out, you know, to Bob Ludwig and wanted him because they were unhappy with the mastering job that was done on Electric Ladyland. So they were like, hey, man, next time we're going to fix this. So, you know, so Ludwig got involved and he ended up doing Band of Gypsies. And then prior to Jimmy's death, Eddie and Jimmy went up and did a Nightbird Flying and Dolly Dagger single, because that was the first single they were thinking about, is to kind of preview the record. So, you know, they were already aware of it even on that level. You know, that, look, Jimmy wanted to have hands-on even on the mastering process. So, you know, if you think about it, he'd be creating a new song in his own recording studio, mixing it in his own recording studio, supervising the mastering. You know, artists in 70, you know, a lot of them had to deal with guys in lab coats telling them, hey, you got another 15 minutes and the next band's in here. Let's go finish it up.
So when it comes to something like Electric Ladyland, do you have an opinion on the very first pressing? You likely know about the blue or the white text on the inside of the gatefold.
Yeah, that's deep. I mean, I know. I think it, you know, you get subjective with these things, like, oh, do I like the Barclay versus the side C of the Reprise? Or, I think we all have our favorites, and, you know, it's a subjective thing, but I think that, you know, it's that stuff exists out there, and if it's something that, you know, it's kind of been your reference and your go-to, it's hard to do an apples-to-apples comparison, for example, to something taken right from the flat tape. Mm-hmm. So, because at that point, you're definitely making taking advantage not only of the technical improvements that have been made since, say, 67, but at the same time, you got a heavier weight vinyl, you're having a better opportunity, I think, to present a more accurate picture of the mix than, you know, those records. So I think it's cool that people dig certain pressings. I'm certainly in the same place, not just for Jimmy, but for other artists. But I think our job is less to mirror those than to present, the music he left it in as close to the state as he left it as possible.
Yeah, those details can be very distracting. I get that.
It's cool. Look, fans' passion is great. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's great. And if someone's like, oh, man, you know, the Cry of Love on Polydor from the UK, and, you know, and it's funny because when you do the research and you see and you're like, well, actually, that's a copy tape. And, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, it's like, but it's okay, because if that's the album that made a deep connection with the fan, that's a great thing. I totally get it and understand it. And there are some folks that, for whatever reason, think that the mono is better than stereo. I mean, I don't share that view, particularly with Hendrix. It might be with other music, but I think, you know, so much of what they were trying to do with panning and, you know, soundscapes are integral to the presentation of the music. But hey, man, it's all good. You know, if you dig Jimmy and Mono, we've made it available for you in those formats as well.
Was he involved in the stereo mixes of the songs?
Totally.
Okay. All right.
Totally.
Because I understand a lot of people want mono because they think that's how the artist was thinking at this time. And the stereo was done outside of the artist's control. But what you're saying is Jimmy was there for both.
No. Jimi Hendrix was absolutely there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
In the case, for example, of Axis, you know, the oft-told story of how he lost one side of the mixes in the cab. I mean, you know, look, who knows? Jimmy may have been unhappy with Chaz trying to mix an entire album in a day. And was like, you know what, we're going to go back and do side two again tomorrow. So who knows, you know, but I think, you know, that he was most certainly involved in mixing. And that mixing, you know, as Kramer says, was four-handed. So he and Jimmy were working the console really on, you know, whether it's 1983 or whether it's Easy Rider or Dolly Dagger. I mean, that was, they developed a process of mixing that, you know, suited both of those guys and obviously sounded pretty great.
Well, look, I own Jimmy first pressings all the way back, but the ones that I listen to, the ones that I play, are the reissues from Experience Hendrix, because I think they just sound great, and they give my first pressings a rest, but I love the packaging, and they sound brilliant. So you guys have done a fantastic job of preserving the legacy there. Are all Jimi Hendrix vinyl issues direct from the analog source?
No. We've had some that are and some that aren't. Forgive me, I can't say exactly off the top of my head, but we have had some all analog. I think certainly Berkeley was all analog, Monterey was analog, Miami was analog. I'd have to go back and look, but then there were some that are not, because, you know, in the mixing process, Kramer would use some digital technology or something of that nature. So we always try. We sticker every record we put out and, you know, try to be as clear as we can with regard to what is kind of all analog and what mm-hmm. is not.
Okay, I'm going to keep a lookout on the stickers on my records. John, I know you have to go. Again, it's a pleasure having you here on the show. I want to remind folks that Both Sides of the Sky, the third of the Jimi Hendrix trilogy of unearthed recordings, is coming out on March 9th. You can go check out the version of Manish Boy right now. I'll have it posted on thevinylguide.com. But, of course, jimihendrix.com is your source for all things things Jimi Hendrix. And to hear more of the story John alluded to earlier, he's the author of several books. You can go to Amazon, Google his name, John McDermott, and you'll find several tomes with more information on the life and times of Jimi Hendrix. And, of course, the music. John, thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, we're happy to do it, and appreciate the support of fellow fans such as yourself, and I hope you really enjoy the new record.
Oh, we will. Thanks. All righty. Thanks again, John. Amazing conversation and such a great insight to such a brilliant artist. Of course, I want to remind everyone, Both Sides of the Sky, the last big stash of unheard Hendrix recordings, available March 9th. Well, you may have heard them before, maybe on bootlegs or some lo-fi system, but I tell you, what Experience Hendrix does to the recordings of Jimi Hendrix is make them sound fantastic. Even, you know, Electric Ladyland and Axis and Are You Experienced, check out the copies that Experience Hendrix does, especially on vinyl. They sound brilliant. So pick those up if you don't have those as well. Of course, you could find them just about any record retailer online or at jimihendrix.com. Alrighty, well, that's it for this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thanks again for tuning in. Make sure you share with your friends. I'm going to do my best to be back next week with a brand new episode. I am traveling a bit, so if I don't, you know why. It's not that I'm not thinking about you. It's just, man, I'm probably on a plane somewhere. But a bunch of great episodes are coming up, so I can't wait to share them with y'all. Make sure you get our apps, the Vinyl Guide apps, available at the Apple Store and Google Play. Simply go to those stores, those online stores, type in The Vinyl Guide, and there you go. It's a free app where you can listen to all 100-plus episodes and interviews we've had here on The Vinyl Guide. Alrighty, until we talk next time, keep spinning. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to nate@thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram @vinylguide. Until next time, keep spinning.